Hi, I'm Jean Kissel. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. And I want to thank you all. This should be called the sincere meeting. Because after going this morning, then the lunch, it's awfully tempting at 2 o'clock to find something else to do. So I just know when I show up to this meeting, I'm sincere. Early in my program, my spot, I didn't want to do something for somebody. I think it was a relative. And I discussed it with my sponsor. Somehow, I never got to a point where I would think she would agree with me, but I always thought she might, you know. I went and complained about doing something, and English was her second language, so she often used words inappropriately, but they became a part of the program in our group. She said, "Jean, be generous." And she said, "You will never be faulted for being generous." And I want to tell you, this is one of the most generous conventions I have ever been to. Everybody is just, it's perfect, you know. And I was talking to Katie at lunch, and I was saying, there is such an atmosphere, because it is such a generous convention, everybody's happy. Nobody's complaining. You don't see any little group over there saying, "Oh, crap," you know. It's great. And I want to thank you so much for asking us and for letting us be a part of this program. I brought my favorite guest with me. I didn't have much of a choice. I chose Jack. I'm going to tell you a little bit about me and how I got here. There used to be a commercial, remember, for an oven cleaner. It used to say, "What's a nice girl like this doing in a place like this?" Well, I spent a lot of years saying, "Who am I doing here? Why am I doing this?" You know, always feeling like, you know, gosh, this is terrible, you know. Jack was always giving me challenges. You know, he'd say to me, "Well, if only you did this, everything would be better." You know, like cook, like we were kidding at lunch about the way it was served. I said, "Yeah, sure, this is the way I always serve dinners at home." But I actually did at one point when he said he didn't stay home at night and he had to go out and drink because dinners just didn't look that good in our house. So I bought some parsley, you know. Parsley is not the answer to alcoholism. And somehow Nancy this morning reminded me of something that happened. You know, we met in the 50s, the early 50s, so we've gone through the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. But in the 60s, Jack was a hippie, and he was into a lot of things. And during the hippie period, that's also when women were not wearing bras. But that's not me. I've always been very inhibited, you know. But he kept saying, "Well, you're just not hip like all these other women, you know. That's why I run around. I mean, they're, you know, they've got some zip to them, you know." So I said, "Okay." So I bought this dress, and we were going to this wedding. Well, leave the bra off, you know. I bought a dress with a black top. Unfortunately, you can see through black. So I walked around the whole night like this, you know, which really defeated the whole purpose, you know. And then I gave that up. But I was always willing to try whatever I could. I'm sitting on a stool because I found the final thing that I cannot have any control over. I have a sciatica nerve. And I was sure that it would be gone by 2 o'clock today. And this morning, I could tell it wasn't. So we went to an alternate plan, and Lloyd got me a stool. So that's why I'm sitting on a bar stool, which is apropos at this convention. I spent a lot of years sitting on a bar stool watching him, you know. He was just running around it. I was born in Amityville, Long Island. I was born in Brooklyn, actually. And then we went to Brooklyn, yeah, heck with the Bronx. And then we moved to Long Island. I was brought up in Long Island. I was brought up in a little town called Amityville, not the Amityville Horror. Good thing Jack's not speaking, or he'd tell you different. I can get away with anything today. He gets no rebuttal. Don't anybody talk to him. I decided when I was 17 that I wanted to leave home. I was brought up by my grandmother and my great-grandmother, And as the years passed, I realized how terrific they were. They were really very modern. They were terrific. But I decided at 17 I wanted to move out of the house. Well, I'm not that young, you can tell. And in that little town, you didn't just go and get an apartment. You had two choices. You either got married or you moved to New York City and got a job. Well, at 17, I didn't feel I was ready to move to New York City and get a job, so I got married. I found out a lot in the program about my motives. That is not a good motive to get married. We had a little girl, and that marriage didn't last very long. And so when that marriage was over, I sat down, and I did something that I think is second in destruction to the alcoholic's drinking. It's the Al-Anon thinking. I sat down, I did some thinking. This was going to be a pattern that was going to go on for a lot of years, but I didn't know it. I said, okay, I made a mistake. I know what the mistake is, so now I'm going to correct it. I'm going to move to New York City. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to meet this really great guy. I'll have a place to live. He'll be really terrific. We'll get married. We'll move to the suburbs, probably Connecticut because I came from Long Island. And we'll have, you know, a boy and a girl and a dog and a cat and a station wagon. And he'll sit and read the paper while I make dinner. And we'll go to PTA meetings and help the children with their homework. So now I met Jack, so I'm going to tell you what really happened. I did move to New York City. And I did get a job, and I was in a rooming house in Greenwich Village, and it was on 12th Street, right down the block from the new school, and it was one of those old brownstones that they make into rooms, and as you go upstairs, the rooms get smaller and smaller, and I was on the top floor. So these rooms were very small, very claustrophobic, so whenever you were in your room, you left the door open, you know, and I just happened to notice that down the hall, this really cute guy had moved in. I didn't meet him right away, but you know something? Every time he opened up his door, what a mess. He needed somebody. One night I was sitting in my room with the door open, and he came walking down the hall. And he had a quart of beer underneath one arm and a book of poetry underneath the other arm. And he came in my room, and he sat down, and he read me poetry, and he drank his beer. You know, it occurred to me years and years after I was telling that a lot of times that he never did offer me any of that beer. You know, sometimes you get a hint, and you just don't even know it. There was one Al-Anon in L.A. that they had a Jewish wedding where you share a cup of wine. She said when he passed her, the cup was empty. Why didn't she know? You know, why didn't I know? He wouldn't share his beer, you know. But he read me poetry that night. He read me Dylan Thomas. Now, I did not know that night that Dylan Thomas had died of alcoholism in New York City. I also didn't know that Jack had come to New York City to take Dylan Thomas's place. Dylan Thomas was a great poet, and the closest Jack got to taking his place was sitting on his stool at the White Horse Tavern, trying to drink as much as Dylan Thomas drank, you know. But you know something? I'd taken his resume that night. I asked him a lot of questions. He was the oldest of five children from South Bend, Indiana. He was Irish Catholic. He had graduated from the University of Notre Dame. He'd been in the Army. He had come to New York City to go to Fordham and Columbia. And he said something about maybe wanting to be an actor. Well, you know, we'll deal with that when we get to Connecticut. And but is that not a resume for what I told you I was thinking about for, you know, my future? What more could you ask for? So Jack and I got together. He used to say for years that I got a knife, a fork, a spoon, a cup, a dish, locked the door, and he never had a chance. And it took me a lot of years to accept that he was probably right. You know, you hate to admit that about yourself. And we got together, and we got along real well, and we got married, and, you know, we were married, it was about a year after we were married, And, you know, it occurred to me, you know something? I don't think we're on our way to the suburbs. Something is wrong. So I sat down and I did some thinking. Now, if you're me, I was an only child brought up by a grandmother and a great-grandmother, and, you know, all I knew about the Irish was that they drank a lot, but I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I just thought they had parties all the time, and they had a lot of children. So I decided, well, you know, I can't do too much about the drinking. He seems to be able to handle that himself, you know. We'll have some more children, because that's probably what he needs so we can move to the suburbs. Well, we had 3 children, which made a total of 4 with my little girl that he adopted, and we were still not in the suburbs. Well, you know, and things were happening, things that I didn't really understand. I did not know anything about alcoholism when I got here. I did not, until the day I got to Al-Anon, I did not know about alcoholism. And in my house at home, I'm sure my perception is incorrect, but I think we had 1 bottle of whiskey the whole time I was growing up. My grandmother literally used it for medicinal purposes. A little whiskey and water for a toothache, a stomachache, whatever, you know, and for New Year's Eve, you know, and that was it. And also, I have to tell you, when I met Jack, his drinking did not bother me. He was fun. He was clever. He, you know, we went to parties. We went to clubs. And it was okay. You know, every once in a while, he would drink too much, but doesn't everybody. And I really was not bothered by his drinking. And but now, by now, with all these children and a job and everything else, things started coming, you know, I started to notice little things that were going on. Like, do you know something, Jack? He would want to come home for dinner. Do you know that those actors and actresses wouldn't let him? They had to have 1 more beer and they were talking to him. I mean, it wasn't Jack's fault. And do you know something else about Jack? Jack's a full-blown alcoholic, but he never had more than 2 beers. He told me so, you know. And I started noticing things that he would do, like really just not show up. And then he would tell me all these things, and I'd say, okay, and we'd agree. And 1 year we went to do our income tax, we had to have an addendum on it, an extra page, because he had 32 jobs. And I thought, see, I never knew anybody who had 32 jobs in 1 year. You know, and a couple of people I knew said, gee, he's really not much of a, you know, he must be a failure at these jobs. I sort of looked at it as somebody really trying, you know. And we start to develop those Al-Anon to alcoholic, you know, reactions to things. Well, you know, he would come home, and he had a job as a short order cook at a delicatessen in Brooklyn. And he came home, and he said, they fired me. I'd say, well, they are really stupid, Jack. They just fired the best short order cook they ever had. And he'd look at me and say, you know, you're right. And I gave it, you know, because I didn't want him to be unhappy. I didn't want him to feel like a failure. They also fired the best ambulance attendant they ever had in St. Vincent's. They fired the best of a lot of things, you know, 32 of them. And I started thinking about all these things one day. And I thought, you know, something's really wrong here. I'm going to, you know, things aren't working out. Well, isn't it amazing? If you live with an alcoholic, I can't believe it. Every time you say, okay, this is not working, it's over, we're going to move on, the lucky Irish, you know what. He got a job teaching at a school in New Rochelle. Well, now New Rochelle is not exactly Connecticut, but it is the suburbs. So off we went to New Rochelle. And I said, see? I knew it was New York City. I knew it was those actors. You know, I was in the program about 5 years when I met a very successful actor's wife. And she was an Al-Anon, too. And she and I were talking one day, and she was listening to me. When I got finished, she said, Gene, the theater didn't do it. He's an alcoholic. And I had never really thought about it that way. I still blamed, you know, all the environment. And we moved to New Rochelle. And Jack taught high school there, and I loved it. I really thought I had the answer. I knew that if we got out of New York and away from all that theater and everything, everything would be okay. I didn't know anything about alcoholism, so I didn't know about grandiosity. I didn't know about rebelliousness. I didn't know about all those things that are all those side issues of alcohol. It's not just the drinking. The drinking, half the time, I don't think is as bad. But it's all those things they do behind the drinking. And 3 years teaching in New Rochelle, where he was very successful, they wanted him to take a course so that he could get tenure. And he said no. And I could not understand that. It just was unbelievable to me. No, I'd go do it, you know. But he didn't do it, and he lost his job. They didn't, you know, his feeling was, change the rules, you know, and they didn't do it. And he lost that job. And I, you know, you store all these things up in your head, and you think about them. But just in the nick of time, he met an ex-movie star in Westchester County, and they decided to start a theater. And it's kind of like Nancy was talking about. I always fell for him. He was going to open up a McDonald's franchise in Australia one time. I often think that might have been a good idea, you know? Maybe we shouldn't have done that. We should have done that. He's shaking his head, yes. But that theater, that was the year. The year he was starting that theater was the year that things started to change with me. I remember, if I had to say, what year did the drinking really start to bother you? I would have to say it was that year. Because it was the thing where in the morning I would go out to get the newspaper, and I'd bring the newspaper and my husband in from the porch, you know. It's so funny, because you bring them in, you know, you sit them down, and then you run back out to see, did anybody see? It always tickles me, you know, the whole world knows about the drunk, right? So when he becomes sober and he's going to AA, we become anonymous, you know. You think we take an ad out in the paper. You know, an ad in the New York Times, the LA Times, Jack sober. When they get sober, don't you love all the people who say, I could told you that. See, I've been waiting for him. Why didn't they tell me? So that year, Jack, with the things that started like that, and then there were things like he would forget to come home, you know. He would call me up and say, I'd say, where are you? You're supposed to be home for dinner. He'd say, well, I'm over here, I'm doing this big business and things. And I just didn't seem to work. And he was drinking a lot that year, and he was also starting then to take other things. Now, alcohol never scared me. I drank alcohol, but any kind of, you know, marijuana, pills, those kind of things, they upset me. And at the end of that year, needless to say, that theater did not work. And I was ready one more time. This is it. We're finished. We're done. Finished. And Jack came home and said, I got a job directing a community theater in Ohio. Really sounds great. Well, you know, my thinking went a little bit further this time, because I had had a lot of disappointments, you know, a lot of, it's going to be different this time, we're going to make it, you know, everything's going to be different. And so I let him talk about going to this theater, and he said he would go, this was in August, he would go to Ohio, and we would stay back in New Rochelle, and by December, he would know whether or not he liked it, and if he did, he would send for the family. And he had all these plans, and I did an Al-Anon thing before I even came to Al-Anon. I just kept saying, because I did some thinking. He goes to Ohio, I stay in New Rochelle, and I never see him again. So when it came time for him to leave, I drove him to the airport to say goodbye to him forever. And we did. I said goodbye, drove back home. I heard him pitch an Alcoholics Anonymous when he was new, and he talked about getting this job in Ohio and deciding to leave his family forever. Well, two people saying goodbye to each other forever. But you know, I could understand me saying goodbye to him forever, but him saying goodbye to me forever. come on. How's he going to get along without me? Suffer. So, but I didn't have any Al-Anon yet. So 30 days later, the end of September, I got a phone call. He said, Gene, this is the best place I've ever lived. The theater is great. The people are great. I found a house upstairs and downstairs that we can rent. He said, you're going to love it. And then those three words, I need you. Okay, there went my thinking. I packed up. I told everybody I was moving way out west because I'd never been out of New York. I now call Ohio back east. And we packed up and we went to Ohio by train at night. And John, who was going to be 6 years old the next day, had had dental work done in the morning, and he was sick all night on the train. Christy was okay. Our oldest daughter was in the ninth grade. She cried the entire night because she was leaving her friends behind. And Melinda was a baby I was still carrying around. The train was an hour and a half late, and Melinda cried for an hour and a half. We had the dog with us because they wouldn't take him in the baggage car. I got off the train in Ohio. Guess who was not there to meet me? I looked around. I said, where is my thinking? What am I doing here? We were 4 years in Ohio. 2 years, Jack directed the community theater. He was very successful. His plays were very successful. Except that he was a little too exciting for them. They decided they would go for a little less success and a little more peace and quiet. And at the end of 2 years, they did not renew his contract. So he got a job, a really great job, 20 miles away in a little town called Ada. He was going to be professor of the theater department at Ohio Northern University. Wow, I like that, a professor's wife. I didn't even go to college, you know. This is great, you know. So we moved to this, and this little town was so cute. It was just this one little main street. It was one of those towns where if you go like this, it's gone. I thought, this is going to be great. But it was a Methodist school that didn't believe in drinking. That little town stayed cute for about 5 minutes. You know, an alcoholic just has to worry about hiding a bottle. Have you ever tried to hide a whole alcoholic in a little town? And this was not a quiet alcoholic. This was the 60s. Jack became a hippie. He used to wear a leather vest with fringe, long hair, beard, mustache, not pretty like yours. And he had a peace symbol he wore around his neck. It was made out of hammered iron. One of the students made it. It was about this big. Looked more like a weapon than a peace symbol. He gathered 26 students on campus and was encouraging them to blow up the administration building. I said, we have this policeman that used to follow me around to the stores and things, you know, because it got out that this man was dangerous, you know. And they didn't renew his contract. He came home and told us and said, well, what do you think we should do now? I took one look at the hippie and said, we better go to California. And we did. The four children all flew out here to California, to Long Beach, to some friends of ours. I had one of those AA Al-Anon conversations with Jack. They do these things just to keep us on our toes, you know. I said, all my children are not going to fly in one plane. He looked at me and said, which ones are going in which plane? Why do they do that to us? It just makes us feel like we're so dependent on him. Because I was sure he knew which one should go in which plane, you know. And then we found out if they all went with Cappy, they went half fare, so they all went in one plane. And we packed this big old Chevy up. And we drove across the country with it. And this car was packed. We even had a cooler on the front seat, you know, in the middle of the front seat between us. And Jack had read all these articles about how they pick up hippies in little towns, put them in jail, and nobody ever sees them again. So I did most of the driving. And I'm driving along, and every time we'd get near any kind of population, he'd hide under the dashboard. Now, if you don't know about alcoholism, and you're driving along, and you're looking at your husband under a dashboard with a seat empty next to you, you got to think he's crazy, you know? And he was also, after he sat under the dashboard all day, he was a good alcoholic. He does everything. He was into yoga, too. And all night he'd stand on his head, you know? I always like to remember that trip because I was really kind of scared. I'd drive along, I'd look at him, I'd look at, you know, and I was thinking, you know, if any one of you were to call me and say to me that you were driving across the country and this was what was going on, I'd say, well, for heaven's sakes, get another car, get a plane, get a bus, leave him behind, you know. But I never knew I had a choice. I figured I had to get out here to the West Coast. If the children weren't already out here, I would have just turned the car around and gone back east where I knew somebody. Because if you're under the dashboard, he wouldn't have known if I was driving east or west, you know. So we finally got out here. We came the northern route. We came down San Francisco where he stopped off to see his best friend who beat him up in the park. This is not a good... I got a terrible resentment against San Francisco. I'm the only person I know who hated a whole city because I had another Al-Anon habit, which I developed before, you know, I got to Al-Anon, and that was when he would irritate me too much, I'd just leave him and go home, you know, take the car and go home. Well, I walked out the bar in San Francisco, and my gosh, those big mountains, you know, so I felt trapped, I felt powerless, and I blamed it on San Francisco, you know. Can't do anything about him, but maybe I can get that city, you know. We finally got down here to Los Angeles, down to Los Angeles, and it was going to be the last 3 years of Jack's drinking, but we didn't know that, of course. My whole motive in getting down here or getting to Los Angeles and getting the children was to get a job, take those children, and get rid of Jack. Because I'd had it. That was a horrendous trip across this country, you know. Him trying to find all the old bars he used to drink in and, you know, I mean, it was a nightmare coming across the country. And so I, you know, but you know something I discovered? Do you know how hard it is to get rid of an alcoholic? It's like gum on your hands, you know. They keep coming back. That's where they got that from. Keep coming back. The Al-Anon will take you back. And he wasn't well enough to get a job because he was literally, by this time, physically sick. He had long, stringy hair. Was a real hippie. Fu Manchu mustache by this time. Evil. He used to have two pair of pants he alternated, a black and red brocade and a gold brocade. He had a flowered shirt he used to wear with ruffles, and he always carried a shoulder bag. Sunglasses night and day. I used to look at him every once in a while, and I'd think, is that cute little guy I met in the village? I don't think so. You know, he came up to my office one time and he left. I said, we didn't know you were married to a hippie. Didn't know it either. And he wasn't much for working, but he was well enough every morning to get out and get the want-ads for me. And he used to drive me to the interviews, and I finally got a job. It was a good job, too. I kept it for 24 years, you know. And But I just, you know, I would sit there at night, and he'd be out and drinking, and because he was an outside, a bar drinker, and he was always in trouble. And so I would sit there, and I used to have a little shoebox. I used to keep our bills in. And now I still do, but I pay him once in a while. I used to keep them very neatly in the shoebox, and I'd sit there with my oldest daughter at night, and I'd say, one for him, one for me. I didn't make that much money, and he didn't have a job. I don't know what I was doing, but it kept me busy, you know. And then she told me that after he got sober, she said, Mom, my biggest resentment was all those years when you used to sit there and do that with the bills. And then the next day, he'd come home with a poem, a rose, promise you everything was going to be different, and off we'd go again. And it was true. You know, if an alcoholic would only be terrible all the time, you could get rid of them. But they're not. They're not. They are loving and sensitive. And I never met anybody in my whole life I was as comfortable with as Jack, and still today. Even when he's mad at me, I'm still comfortable with him, you know? I know he'll get over it, I hope. But he's the kind of guy that, you know, I just always loved him. I just didn't like what he was doing. And all those resentments came up. And people would say to me, why don't you leave him? And I didn't know the answer to that question, so I'd have to stop telling you about it, you know, because I couldn't. I loved him, but I just didn't like what was going on. And but finally, it got, you know, we moved from Silver Lake area up to the Hollywood area. I found this house. It was for rent. I opened up the door, and when you opened up the front door, there was a patio, and on the patio was a barbecue. I knew if we had that house with that barbecue, everything was going to be okay. I said, I don't think we ever used that barbecue. Jack said he did. He used to keep pot in it, you know. But I never knew that. That was another funny thing. This house in Hollywood had this flat roof, and you've heard of ambulance chases, right? Well, every time helicopters would go over, Jack would run out of the house, you know, and off he'd go. And he was growing pot up on the roof, and, you know, he didn't want anybody to know. Which is, by the way, I have to backtrack because I don't have him to rebut. The reason he was sitting underneath the dashboard when we were driving across the country is because he was transporting a bunch of marijuana from state to state. And he figured it's better for me to drive than him, you know. But, I mean, things like that, and other things were happening that were very strange. He'd call up. And it got so, this is the way I talked to him the last couple of years. I'm at the beach. How'd you get there? You're supposed to be home for dinner. And he said, I don't know. I have never in my life gone any place. I didn't know how I got there. I know how I got there. He didn't. You know, I didn't know about blackouts. And we'd all be sitting in the room at night, and the telephone would not ring, and he would answer it. And he'd have this conversation. He'd be talking to somebody. I didn't know about hallucinations. Well, these are strange things when they happen, you know. And I took a lot of trouble. I had a lot of amends to make to Jack when we got to problem, because I went to a lot of trouble to make him miserable. You know, the thing about, I soon discovered he really did not remember what he did last night. So the next morning I would say, do you know what you did last night? He'd say, no, but I'm sure you're going to tell me. And I did. I made up most of it. And that poor guy was so guilty and so miserable. I used to, he'd be in bed asleep in the morning, and I'd go to work, and I'd take his mail, and I'd forward it to his favorite bar. He'd come in, and he'd say, it's embarrassing when you go for a beer, and they tell you you have mail. But I figured, better chance he gets it there than home. And and these things, you know, I spent a lot of time figuring out how to make him feel bad, you know. We went to a place once, and I didn't like the way he was acting, so I left and went home. And he came home later, and I was watching TV, and he put his hands on his hips, and he said, do you know, you've got to stop leaving me all over Los Angeles, you know. He also told me he could have had a date that night, but he felt it necessary to come home and tell me that, you know. My oldest daughter by that time, Kathy, was out of the house, and she was living in Phoenix. And she came home one weekend, and, you know, she said to me, Mom, look at this house. Look at these children. How can you live like this? And I discovered something about me. If you don't see it and you don't say anything to me about it, I can deny it and I can just make rationalize it and forget it. But if you tell me about it and show it to me, I have to admit that it's there. I have to admit that it's actually happening. And when she said that, I looked around. I looked at that house we were living in. And we had moved John out of his bedroom because the roof leaked and I'd torn up the rug and thrown it out the window. The electric wasn't working right. It was a mess. But we owed about 3 months back rent. When you owe rent, you do not call the landlord and say, please fix the roof. You have a low profile and a great prayer that they will forget they even own the house. And I looked at the children. And I looked at John. John was going to be 12 years old. And John used to come home from school and go in his room and lock the door and go in his closet and lock the door and go and sit on the shelf of his closet because he was so scared to live in that house. Christy had taken over the house because I was too busy chasing Jack around. And she used to call me up every day and ask me what was for dinner. I'd tell her what to take out of the freezer. To this day, she says, my mother never taught me how to cook. She just taught me how to defrost. And Melinda was only, she was going to be 7, and I didn't think she knew anything that was happening until I heard a pitch in preteen, and she knew everything. But that's what I looked at that day when I saw what was going on. And that night, we told Jack he had to leave. And that was it. Well, remember what Jack looked like, the hippie with the brocades and the bag and the whole thing, right? From Fu Manchu, the long hair. He got arrested that night. And I hadn't been to Al-Anon yet. So I went down to jail to try to bail him out. Well, they took one look at me, and I was, you know, I was younger, but I pretty conservative looking. And the jail had an argument with me. He said, I don't think your husband is in this jail. I said, yeah, I know he is, because some kid called me and told me he's in this jail. And he just kept arguing with me. And finally I said, I know he's here. His purse is laying right over there. But you know something? He wouldn't let me bail him out. And I went home. And I went, from now on, everything I tell you, I do not know why. That night, I know why it happened, but I don't know why the incidents. I had truly surrendered. When he got home the next morning, I met him at the door. I'd kicked that man out of that house hundreds of times. You know, I'm going to get a divorce, get out of my life. You know, we'd scream. I'd scream at him. Anytime anybody would walk by our house and they'd say, somebody in that house is sick, they would have said, that woman that's screaming is the one, you know, because he just drank. I screamed. And I told him, and you know, I stood there calmly and quietly and said it. Whenever an Al-Anon asked me what I think about what she should do about leaving an alcoholic, I tell her how I felt that morning. I was calm. My stomach wasn't churning. I just looked at him and I said, Jack, I can't live like this anymore, and I owe more than this to the children. You've got to leave, and I want you gone by noon. And I'm going to come home and make sure you're gone. And I went to work, and I did something I still to this day do not know why I did it. I opened up the phone book and I looked up alcoholism. And I made a phone call and I talked to a woman. I told her about Jack and I told her about me. She told me that I was married to a man who was probably not the SOB I thought he was, but that a man with a disease of alcoholism for which there is help. And she gave me a telephone number. She'd go home and ask him if he wants help. If he says yes, you give him this phone number to call. And I was just going to hang up the phone because I figured I'd found the answer. And she said, wait a minute, just a minute. And I said, what? She said, you know, you haven't always done everything right over the years. But that's okay, because she didn't know any better. But there is a place for you to go, and that's Al-Anon. And she made me promise that I would go to Al-Anon, and she gave me the number to call. And I said, okay. And I went home, and I asked Jack. I woke him up. It wasn't easy. I didn't know about passing out either. And I asked him, I said, do you want help? And he said, yes. He often says in his pitch, I didn't know what she was talking about. He needed help to sit up. I said, well, I've got a number for you to call. So he said, okay, and I dialed the number, and I handed him the phone. And that day, she agreed to go up to a 12-step house in Oxnard. As much as I hated San Francisco, I loved Oxnard. I like San Francisco now, too. But then we went up there, and I left him at a 12-step house. And he was there for 1 week. And that was on a Monday. On Wednesday, he called me. He said, Jean, you know, all the things I told you about Alcoholics Anonymous, because he had told me if it had anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, he was not staying, because his father was an Alcoholics Anonymous, and my father-in-law was mostly just cranky. And it was not a good example, and he wasn't going to be like his father, and that was it. And he said, you know the things I told you about Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, yes. And he said, forget them. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm where I should be. And I said, and I could tell there was a difference. There's just a difference in his voice. And that Friday night, I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. I went all dressed up. I took a pad and pencil. I thought it was a one-night, seminar. Care and feeding of a newly sober alcoholic. I got there, and they weren't terribly interested in Jack. One woman came up to me and she said, who's a problem drinker you're coming to Al-Anon for? And I said, my husband. From that day to this day, I've never been ashamed of loving an alcoholic. And during the meeting, someone said something about an alcoholic, and she said, you know, you girls can do a lot worse than love an alcoholic. I love that woman from that day on. She became my sponsor. And in June, we're going to have 25 years on this program. And she's been my sponsor all these years. The last few years, she has not been as available because she's had Parkinson's, but I always knew she was there in case. And last Friday, she died. She's not there anymore. But you know something? She gave me roots. You know, and I'm going to say something now that if she were here, she would get very angry at me for saying. But Jack often says that if it weren't for my sponsor, Margot, and Al-Anon, he probably would still be sober, but we wouldn't be married. And I think that's true. I just think that, you know, she's the one who changed things for us. She's the one who made us a family. And she worked hard on it. She worked very subtly because she knew what she was dealing with. And she loved me. She was the first person who patted me on the head and said, you know, you have very nice hair, you know. And she did things like that that made me just want to pay attention to her. She also had a German accent that scared the heck out of you. After that first meeting was over, she said to me, you have any children at home? And I said, yeah, I've got three still at home. She said, they go to Al-Anon. I said, okay, what's that? Because I knew, I'm one of those people, I walked into that Al-Anon meeting and I was home. I loved Al-Anon. And I'd go home. Every time I go to a meeting, I had this headache, you know. I couldn't understand it because I loved it and I had this headache. Well, I discovered it was from going... You go like that for an hour and a half, you're going to have a headache too. But every time somebody said something, they felt like I felt. I'd never known that. You know, I'd always worked with people who told me what I should do and what I should say, and a family that disapproved. You know, my grandmother even had the audacity to tell me not to marry Jack because he drank too much. Well, you can imagine what I said to her. I never got a chance to make direct amends to her for that because she died, but she'd be pleased at how he turned out. And I went to Al-Anon, and my kids went to Al-Anon. The first time we went, just to give you a little indication of my sponsor, who was in our house, her and she, because both Jack and I were scared of her. We all took the children. The two girls went to preteen, and John went to Allentine. So the next day I called her up, and I said, John really doesn't like it, so he's not going to go anymore, but the girls like it, so they'll go. She says, oh, no. If John lives in your house, he goes to Allentine. So I went back to Jack and said, she says he has to go. Did you ever try to take a 12-year-old boy someplace he doesn't want to go? But John went for a couple of weeks, and then whatever he was supposed to hear, he heard. And she made us take him. And, you know, John still goes. When John was 24 years old, he'd been in Al-Anon half of his life. And he still goes to Al-Anon. He's a lot older than that now. And he's got, you know, a whole life from it. But you know something? If he had never gone back for some reason, do you know what that lady did in her subtle way? She made Jack and I be consistent about something, and she made us a team. And my children all say the worst thing that the program did for them was to make their mother and father a team. You know? And I started working on being the things that I always wanted to be. I always wanted to be a good wife, and most of all, I wanted to be a good mother. And, you know, it's never too late to start. She started telling me, like, you know, when the kids would go out, I wouldn't say anything to them, but I'd say to Jack, Jack, you need to wear a sweater. It's getting chilly. Yeah, he wasn't the child. They were. And she turned my thinking around. She said, Jack doesn't need a sponsor. They do. And I started paying attention. And things would happen. Like, I had one daughter that used to have fits, get hysterical all the time. But I mean, really bad. But the way I dealt with it was to go in and yell louder than her that she was disturbing everybody. And one night, I didn't do that. I walked in, I put my arms around her, and I said, what can I do to help you, sweetheart? And I said, oh my God, this program's working. And Christy, when Christy would want to talk to me and tell me about some boy who had rejected her when she was 10 or 11 years old, I want to say, please, I'm cooking dinner. We got to get to the meeting. There's a lot of fish in the sea. I didn't do that. I sat down with her, and I talked to her, and I explained to her about Al-Anons and how we feel about rejection. And, you know, I heard her pitch an Al-Anon, and she talked, and I never discussed any of it with her, and she talked about how this night, and she said, you know, my mother didn't tell me there was a lot of fish in the sea. She let me find that out for myself. But she talked to me. And John, who had absolutely no respect for me by the time I got to this program, because I tried to make him take Jack's place, and all I did was set him up for failure. And, you know, John started to respect me and ask my advice, and I knew it was working. And those children didn't have a chance before they got to Al-Anon. John had a lot of trouble in school, and he went to junior college. He finally got out of high school. He went to junior college, bailed out. Then he went to work for a year. Then he went back to junior college and passed. And he went to his father, and he said, you know, I know it's not possible, but if I could, I would go to the University of Notre Dame as a junior transfer because you went there. And it was sort of an amends to Jack. And, you know, alcoholics, right? He called, and there was a friend of his who had been in the seminary with him when he was 14 to 16 years old. But this man had stayed in and was a priest. And at that time, he was second in command at Notre Dame. So Jack called him. And it turned out he had 10 and a half years of sobriety, and Jack had 8. And he wrote a letter for John that was rigorously honest. He said, this boy may not have the grades that we usually want for a junior transfer, but I think he has found himself. And John went to South Bend, Indiana, and he was friends with that priest, and that priest took care of him. And John started an Al-Anon meeting there. And I always use a wonderful thing that John did, told me about. He said, Mom, he said, you know, I have this big test. And all my friends were saying to me, how can you go to your Al-Anon meeting when you have this big test? And he said, I said to them, you know, if it weren't for Al-Anon, I wouldn't even be taking this test. And in 1982, Jack and I went back to South Bend, Indiana, and we watched our son graduate from the University of Notre Dame. That boy should have been in juvenile hall if he hadn't gone to Al-Anon. We watched them graduate. You know, we sat there. Everybody else, I'm sure, thought they should be there because they paid for it. Jack and I knew it was a miracle to see that boy. Today he's married. He works on a newspaper. He's married to another Al-Anon. She stole him away from me. They have two children. Paloma is 10 today. And Stephen, who's 7. And I have a great relationship with them. I pick them up every day from school. And Stephen loves to shock me. And I don't pay any attention. I just warn him that every once in a while he's going to say it in front of his mother and father and get in trouble. Got in the car on Friday and said, "Oh, Grandma, I'm having a hell of a time in school." And Christy, who had taken over the house, she learned in Alateen that she could do God's work but not God's job. And she gave the house and the children back to me. And she started taking care of herself. And Christy was very bright. She got grants and scholarships, and she went to UCLA, and then she went to law school in Washington, D.C. She was in Washington, D.C. for 3 years. She got a law degree. She was on, what was she on? Law Review. Thank God Jack's here. Between us, we're getting old. Between us, we have one brain left, you know. And she got married and had a baby. Now that's, and then she came home and she graduated, or she took the bar. After she graduated, she took the bar. And you know, in LA, when you take the bar, everybody goes, there's about 600 people that pass the bar in a year, and you all go down to the Shrine Auditorium and you all hold your hand up at once. It's very anticlimactic when you think of the study, the work, the money that goes into that degree. But you know, when you're in this program, that's not the way it happens for us. You know, Don Gates, who was a judge, he's retired now in L.A. He's an Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's Jack's second sponsor because Jack's first sponsor died. Don Gates called, and he said, "You know, if Christy would like me to, I will swear her in my chambers." And we went to Don's chambers, and he swore Christy in. And he let her sit in all the judges' seats. And you know, that doesn't happen any place but this program, you know. And Melinda, who had lots of trouble in and out. But I thought about, I don't know why I thought of this morning. I don't know how many of you know Keith Carpenter. He's enormous, old ex-football player. And we were at the Palm Springs Roundup one year, and Melinda was leading a preteen meeting. And we walked in the room, and there was nobody there. And she was close to tears. And we went into the coffee shop, and I guess Keith caught that things weren't right with Jack. And he said, "Jack, what's the matter?" And Jack said, "Well, Melinda is leading a preteen meeting and there's nobody there and she's feeling bad." And Keith said, "Well, we'll take care of that, Jack." And he just got up and he said, "Okay, everybody finish up. We're going to a preteen meeting." It was one of the biggest meetings at the convention, you know. And, you know, things like that have happened to us on this program. You know, the miracle of it, the miracle of all of it. And, you know, it isn't always ups. There's lots of downs. We've been rich on this program. We've been poor on this program. I've been fat and thin. I don't know which way I'm going right this minute. But Jack had a business, and that business failed. And we lost our house right before we mortgaged the house to keep the business going. I had very grandiosely said to him, "Look, worst thing that can happen, Jack, is we lose the house. Big deal." Well, when we lost the house, I wasn't so sure I meant it. We had a wonderful experience through that because, you know, I kept getting boxes and I put some things in the boxes and I couldn't move out of that little house, you know. And I was supposed to go in Albuquerque for a Southwest Regional that year. And I said to Jack, "It's the weekend we're supposed to move. I better cancel." He said, "No, go. We'll do it. I'll take care of it." And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous came into that little house and did for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know, they came in and they packed us up and they moved us. When I came back, and when alcoholics do something, they don't just pack boxes and throw them in the new place. They unpacked them. When I came home, I had a home, a new home to be in. And I thought about it and I said, you know, which was the better day in my life? The day I moved into that house or the day I moved out? And I believe it was the day I moved out because of all that love that I got from this program. We've always been there to take us. Jack, when he had his business, he had made a lot of money, really was doing good. And he gave away so much of that money. Well, in this last couple of years, so many people have given us so much money. And it's okay, you know? That's what this program is about. We take care of each other. I don't have to be ashamed. I don't have to say, gee, I don't have to make up stories like I used to do for the girls at work. I can just live, and we can love on this program, and the unconditional love that we have. And Jack and I, God, one of the first things my sponsor told me, well, first years, when I still had all these kids at home, she said, Jean, make a relationship with Jack, because sometimes those children will be gone, and it's going to be just the two of you. And it is. It's just the two of us now. We have a lot of trouble, but we work through it. We've never been together as much because I always worked. And then we had a coffee house together. That was one of the few times I called her when she was not well. We were just really not getting along at all. I didn't like the way he put the lettuce on the plate. He didn't like the way I closed the refrigerator, you know. I mean, it was absolute, it was terrible. It was starting to get out to the front where people could hear this, you know. And I called my sponsor and I told her what was going on, and she said, what is your priorities here? I forgot Al-Anon is first. I forgot he's second. I forgot those things. Because both of us were taught by our separate sponsors who didn't really know each other. Al-Anon comes first, Jack comes second, always. And AA comes first, and I come second. We keep those priorities. We get along fine. Everything is okay. But if we try to put the person first, we're in trouble because it builds resentments. And the only thing I have to tell you about is, you know, Jack had that business, he made the money, we lost the house and all that. Well, the coffee house was my obsession. I wanted a coffee house for years, and I'd worked for, I was a little bit like Christy, who had all her grants and things and decided what she was going to do. I had my retirement money. I said, I'm going to open up a coffee house. I need you to do it with me. Well, that didn't work either. And we're now down to Social Security. And all I can say is if you're young enough, save your money. It doesn't work. But you know something that has happened? You know, we have experience to share. There is no pedestal. We are honest, and we're open, and we have each other, and we have a strength. You know, we don't fight with each other because of things. I don't blame him, and he doesn't blame me. And, you know, Johnny Harris, we heard him say very early in the program that a relationship is like paddling a canoe. The ideal thing is you both paddle 50%, but there are times when one person can't paddle that much. There were times when I felt like I was paddling 99%, and there have been times when he's paddled that much. But somehow, in this whole thing, you sort of get a kick out of people who have a one-month stand with somebody and say, that relationship, come on. I met Jack 42 years ago in Greenwich Village, and here we are, you know, and it's been a whole evolution. And I just, you know, I went to that first Al-Anon meeting, and all I wanted was just a typewritten list on what to do with an alcoholic. And you didn't even, you know, you didn't even laugh at me. Instead, you shared with me, and the one thing that you did do for me is you gave me a life. And for that life, I am so grateful, and I am so grateful to be here with you today, and so grateful that I love you and you love me. Thank you.